Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Market Update and Economic Outlook with Chilton Trust. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If anyone should require operator assistance during today's conference, please press star then zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's presentation, Ms. Pepper Anderson. Ma'am, please begin.
Good afternoon. This is Pepper Anderson, President and CEO of Chilton Trust. I am in month two of my tenure with Chilton Trust, so I am very appreciative of the opportunity to speak to you today, and in particular, be joined by my colleagues, Jennifer Foster, Co-CIO of Equities, and Tim Horan, CIO of Fixed Income. And thank you to all of you for joining us today. We stated the agenda for this call as an update on recent market volatility, the U.S. yield curve, the Fed's decision to cut interest rates, trade tensions between U.S. and China, and our broader perspectives on the health of the global economy. That is a lot of ground to cover in 30 minutes. So, Tim, I'd like to start off by asking you to recap for us the catalysts for the recent market volatility and put it into perspective for us.
Thanks, Pepper. And the recent volatility has been triggered by a technical inversion in the yield curve that we had last Wednesday. And what an inversion means is when longer rates dip below shorter rates. And we had an inversion of twos to tens. It happened intraday, and it set off a huge amount of volatility based on the history that inversions, if they are sustainable, and this inversion was not, are precursors to an outright recession. And we have been witnessing pressure on the yield curve all year long, particularly in twos, threes, and five-year U.S. treasuries. And why? Because we've had tremendous buying by foreign central banks of our U.S. Treasury twos, threes, and fives, because we have yield. And right now we're witnessing, for the first time in history of bond markets, negative yield approaching $17 trillion. Just today, the German government issued a 30-year bond at negative 11. Who would buy a 30-year bond with negative yield? Well, German insurance companies and pension funds have no alternative, and so they've been participating. But for those individuals and institutional players who can come to the U.S. market, they have been buying our yields. So when we think about the inversion that we just had, was it so much driven by the fact that the U.S. economy is about to go over a cliff? We don't think so. We think that, yes, we are slowing down from our accelerated growth level that was driven by the Trump's tax cut, but we do not think with this level of participation in the economy by the U.S. consumer who is out there both employed and spending money, that you get that kind of precipitous drop. And so we believe that the Fed cut rates at the July meeting as an insurance policy to sustain growth. And they're still prepared, in our view, our central case, to cut further as needed. But they're not running around with their hair on fire that this is some kind of precipitous drop triggered by an intraday inversion of the yield curve.
Great, thank you. With that as the backdrop, I'd be interested in hearing from each of you what you anticipate we'll see in your respective markets now through the end of the year. And maybe, Tim, since you're speaking, I'll just keep with you for the answer.
For the fixed income market, we think that with the likelihood that we could get between one and two more rate cuts this year, that the front end of the fixed income market through the intermediate sector will continue to benefit from those additional rate cuts. We even look for the long end of the market to trade successfully into those rate cuts because we don't have an outright inflation problem at this point. And we do have this foreign constant buying of our markets. But we do worry, and today was a great example, Pepper, that when the president talks about tax cuts, that can be a negative feedback loop into particularly the long end of our markets, despite the fact that we have an accommodative Fed. Our budget deficit is still expanding, and it's going to surpass $1 trillion in terms of the gap right now. And that's a very negative thing for long ends of markets.
We did have a client question asking specifically what your thoughts are around the 10-year, which is embedded a bit in your answer, but do you have thoughts on what kind of volatility or direction you expect to go in just over the next couple of months?
Great question, Pepper. I think near term, the likelihood is we're going to test lower yield levels. And that could take us all the way down to 130, 125. Maybe even at some kind of extreme, we could see the U.S. Treasury 10-year touch 1%. I would not like to see us end the year at that level because that would be the sign that we have an unhealthy economy and that we're going down. I would like to see the U.S. Treasury 10-year move back out more towards the 180 level. And even at 180, it's a very attractive yield versus negative 60 plus in the German 10-year or over negative 1% in a Swiss 10-year.
Thank you. And Jennifer, turning to you, I know volatility was augmented by the fact that it's August and thinner trading volumes and not as many people around to participate. But help us put some of that in perspective and how you think about the end of the year for the equity market.
Yeah, so the equity markets have clearly had good, strong performance to date. Some of that was makeup from last year's fourth quarter that we felt was overdone on the downside, and we limped into the end of the year. So January and the beginning of this year, especially the Q1, were very strong. And so some of the performance this year I sort of think was a catch-up, but we had good performance even on top of that. And we are entering the seasonal period. August, September, historically through mid-October, are kind of underperforming months for the equity market. And I think it is liquidity-driven in part, but it's also as investors shift their focus to the next, you know, calendar year ahead and start to anticipate what kinds of growth numbers could be out there. It just is typically a time for a lot of volatility, and I think obviously this year is proving that rule out. But what we believe is going on is that the U.S. economy is in fact quite strong even still. The inversion created a lot of concern that we would totally agree with Tim and his team was, you know, maybe a bit misread as an indicator of a recession, an imminent recession, and we would disagree with that. And we get the confidence just simply from looking at broader measures of the economy, talking to the companies in which we're invested. And remember, we're just off of earnings season, and we've been literally spending hours upon hours on conference calls over the last several weeks listening to management teams talk about their business and talk about the economy. Just this morning, we heard from Target and from Lowe's, very good numbers, both yesterday Home Depot, last week Walmart. And if you think about, you know, what percentage of U.S. consumers just those four companies touch, it's a pretty healthy amount. And all four of them were very constructive on what they had to say about the state of the U.S. consumer. Now, the other big issue that is looming and is a cause for concern is trade. It's front and center in the headlines right now. It has been in the headlines all year, although, you know, we were told through tweets and other communications that things were progressing well until about May, when it became a little more challenged, those trade discussions. And I think it's fair to say that there is some level of business confidence that has been affected and eroded as a result of trade talks being less productive at this point in time. So we're keeping our eye on that, and the global companies that reported certainly talked a lot about trade and, you know, how to think about their own planning cycle in the midst of some confusion about trade. But I guess, you know, 2 points keep us somewhat sanguine about this issue and not overly depressed. One is the flexibility of the U.S. corporate infrastructure. It's just a highly resilient group of companies that we have, and their resilience always kind of amazes me. So we're hearing a lot about supply chains that are being moved outside of China. Now, this doesn't happen overnight, but the speed at which it is happening is pretty stunning. Companies are moving to lessen the uncertainty by taking their supply chains and bringing them to Mexico or to other areas throughout Asia. This is a very negative structural development for China, and it is something they're aware of, and the impetus is on the Chinese to resolve this by trying to come to the table with some clarity on trade. So that's one issue that keeps us a bit hopeful. The second, of course, is the political cycle in the U.S. and the fact that it's possible these trade talks continue to be really tough and push us into a real soft economy in 2020, but politically that would be a pretty stupid thing to do. And there are negotiators at the table who are mindful of this cycle. So there's a case to be made that this is the apex of confusion and concern, and that we either get some resolution or we get just kind of a kicking the can down the road, taking it out of the front headlines, a delay, so to speak. We've seen several delays already, and it's very possible that we sort of see another one before year end so that it doesn't become an election year issue. So those are two possibilities for how it will resolve. In the meantime, we are staying focused on the broader economic readings and the messages from management teams that are all pretty positive and constructive for the U.S. domestic economy.
And I would add to that that as the president links this trade issue to the protests taking place in Hong Kong, it strengthens his position.
Mm-hmm. I would totally agree with that, Tim. I think that the fact that President Xi and the Chinese delegation are dealing with really two crises, if you will, at the same time, really suggests that they have incentives to minimize the trade consequences right now so that they can focus on the social unrest issue. And so does that mean we get a deal that's palatable to the U.S. administration? Who knows? But it certainly suggests that maybe we get closer.
You are just alluding a bit to some longer-term thinking. I know even beyond year-end, investors have a lot of concerns about potential for recession. And you mentioned earnings seasons as well. Could you share some of the thoughts and perspective you're hearing from companies themselves and maybe a couple of companies in particular where you feel like they're well-positioned or you're hearing encouraging feedback from them?
Yeah, so I would say a couple things that we're hearing. First of all, you know, companies, again, that have a very, very wide view into consumer activity are very constructive and positive in their comments, and that includes a lot of the banking CEOs, some of the companies I just referred to, you know, Walmart, Home Depot, et cetera. But the other thing we're hearing is that a lot of companies are starting to incorporate sort of a recession, what happens at the end of the cycle. We don't see the end of the cycle imminently. All indicators are positive. There was some weather that definitely stalled things out in the first half of the year. We had one CEO tell us that, you know, his stores, which are sensitive to weather patterns, were, you know, very full. The activity was very robust on sunny days. This is Sherwin-Williams, and they sell paint. But on cloudy or rainy days, you know, obviously you don't paint the exterior of a home during the rain. So I do think weather was also a funky factor. But everybody, without exception, that's consumer-facing, was pretty bullish about the imminent state of things. Home Depot yesterday sort of talked to us, though, what happens at the eventual end of this business cycle, which, of course, will end at some point. We're still in a business cycle, and this is a long-dated cycle. And, you know, our base case is that it's not next year, but it could be kind of year two, three, or four from now. And the interesting point that Home Depot made, and this is really what we look for in a lot of the companies in which we're invested, is, you know, they have some structural tailwinds, they believe, at their back that are going to help push them through even the end of the consumer cycle. And for Home Depot in particular, they're very excited about their penetration with the professional contractor. So that's something that they talked about on their call. They also talked about how, you know, it's unlikely to be a very deep recession when we do eventually go to the end of this business cycle, because the banks are in very good shape, and it's just unlikely to be a repeat of what we saw in 08 and 09. So the companies that are sort of talking about the end of the cycle are still doing it in pretty optimistic terms. For our own positioning, and this has been true really for a long time at Chilton, we look for high quality companies, and one of the measures we look to when we're assessing quality is the durability of revenue growth. So we are always looking for companies that, you know, have kind of good structural tailwinds behind them and that are not entirely dependent on a cycle, so that they can continue to perform even past a business cycle.
Do you want to share any examples of interesting companies you think are?
Sure, be happy to. So one of the companies that has really been a strong performer for us this year and has been in the portfolios for several years, and which we think is really in a very strong position for many years into the future, is Ball Corporation. This is the largest aluminum can producer in the world. A few years ago, they bought Rexam, which was, I think, the number three largest, and they consolidated operations globally. We like Ball because of its stable growth business model. Aluminum cans are becoming the packaging substrate of choice for a lot of consumer beverage companies as the consumer becomes much more keenly aware of the problems with plastic packaging and the sustainability challenges of plastic as a recycling material. Few people realize that less than 10% of the plastic packaging actually ever gets recycled. There's just a lot of challenges to that supply chain for recycling, whereas with aluminum, it's a highly recyclable material, and we have 70% of the alumina that's ever been mined actually still in existence. That's how highly efficiently recyclable the material is. So we're seeing a lot of new beverage launches. Most of you have probably observed the new Diet Coke cans that were launched last year that are the tall, skinny ones. You can envision the Monster Energy drink cans that are the big fatties. You can envision the small Red Bulls, and all of these are specialty cans, which is Ball's specialty, no pun intended. These are the cans that Ball has retrofitted its plants to be able to make and produce in mass on a global basis, and they have over two times the capacity of their next competitor for these specialty sizes and shapes, and this is by and large the preference of these new beverage launches. So we think we're in the second inning of this substrate shift, which will strongly accrue to Ball's great advantage. And given that it's a kind of staple in the essence of its business, in, you know, being tied to beverages and to companies like Pepsi and Coca-Cola, but yet it has growth because of this structural shift, that's exactly the kind of name we feel really excited about being invested in at this stage in the business cycle.
The last thing I'd be interested in your perspective on is how to think today, and we received several questions about this, about how you would think about investing or staying invested in an equity portfolio. The investor who is already invested has benefited from some appreciation, wondering if maybe this is a time to take some profits off the table. The latter, the investor who hasn't yet put some money to work, is maybe sitting on liquidity, wondering, did I miss it? Should I be waiting? You've alluded to some of the things that you're watching for, but specifically, how would you share guidance? And Tim, I've been trying to give you a little bit of a break since you're, I have the last couple of ounces of your voice and laryngitis, so thank you. So if you have, if there's things you're watching that we should be mindful of as well.
So I'll jump in with the equity question. It does feel like this has been a long bull run, although remember last year, you know, the market wasn't up because of the late, you know, fourth quarter performance that was negative. So we have had a few sort of mini corrections in this long equity run, and first quarter of 2016 was the one prior to the fourth quarter of 2018. So we've had these corrections in these moments in time, and this may be, we may be in the midst of another one right now. You know, this volatility may persist for a few more weeks. But I think the bigger picture that gives us comfort is, you know, A, the imminent health of the economy is very real, and that's always where we take our most comfort from. And B, you know, the absolute valuation of the equity market, while I can't argue that it's cheap, I also have a hard time arguing that it's terribly expensive. We're looking at about 17.5 times forward PE multiple right here, which is higher than history, which is around 15.5 times. However, inflation is so very low, and inflation is sort of the enemy of equity compounding over time, wealth compounding over time. So with that being so low, there's an argument that the PE should be a bit higher than history. With the economy being intact, there's an argument that's the case. So, you know, we are a bit more expensive than history, but we're nowhere near the levels we saw in the 90s, you know, and in different periods of time where things got very frothy. There are pockets that are a bit frothy, certainly, and as stock pickers, you know, we work really hard to try to avoid those pockets of valuation where there isn't that quality and durability support that's going to sustain those valuations. So the valuation picture feels okay to us. But I think what maybe feels even more persuasive is this concept of there is no alternative. I mean, the 10-year is at 1.6. And the dividend yield of the S&P 500 is at 2%. And recall that the dividend yield has a growth bid below it. Dividends grow over time. And so there's some inflation protection to that. So, yes, it's not a contractual instrument the way that a bond is. And, you know, you are taking the leap of faith in the continued performance of the companies that make up the S&P 500 in that case. But right now, and for a long time, these companies have really been impressive to us with their resiliency and their ability to continue to grow. And we're putting together a collection of companies that we think have that durability and can continue to perform.
And what I would add to that is that we are seeing a Federal Reserve that is responding to the challenge as it sees the economy. It wants to sustain this growth trajectory, and it's doing everything to do that despite the criticism of the president. The president would like to see the Fed do much, much more, but that would not necessarily be appropriate given the full employment backdrop and given where the other uncertainties are around the world with the trade disputes, all of which cannot be modeled successfully. So I think that we're at a moment where the U.S. is still the lead sled dog in the global economy, and provided that U.S. consumers continue participating at the level at which they're participating, we are likely to see the sustainability of that.
We would agree. There's a lot of evidence that, household formation and some of these types of measures of consumer spending power are really moving in the right direction.
Positive direction.
Continue to support housing market and all the spending that goes along with that. And, there's just a lot of economic indicators that they're still really, really flashing green.
Mortgage interest rates 100 basis points below where they were last year. So the affordability becomes a powerful catalyst for additional growth in the economy.
And I am of the mindset, and I think Richard shares this as well, that there's actually quite a risk that, we see equities kind of accelerate their valuation from here simply because of the TINA, there is no alternative. Where are some of these large companies that need yield, that need return, going to go? And could there be kind of a technical reallocation towards equities that give it a very strong bid? So we are not making any dramatic changes, even despite the volatility that's happening. And volatility is never fun to live through. It's always, requires an iron stomach. But this is seasonally appropriate. And when we look at sort of the broader indicators, we come back to feeling like there's no reason to make major changes here.
Particularly to your comments about volatility, but the longer-term perspective, if one has a longer-term investment horizon, yep, and can turn a little bit of a blind eye to the volatility, the underlying strength is something we feel comfortable with. And it's interesting to have both of you on the same page, because fixed income and equity markets don't always agree. And I know from talking with both of you that the variety of indicators you're looking at between business and consumer confidence, the yield curve and the shape of it, all these indicators, you are both coming in your teams to the same conclusion and the same macro outlook, which I find to be reassuring. And we'll continue to watch all that and continue to talk to everyone about our view as it evolves over time. So I'd like to thank you both, Jennifer and Tim, for sharing your thoughts with us, and to everyone who dialed into this call for your time and attention. I know there are questions that were sent in that we didn't get the chance to discuss today, so we would love the opportunity to talk with you offline about anything that's on your mind, or if we've sparked additional thoughts from this call, please do let us know, and we look forward to continuing the dialogue. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.